I promised to you all that we would all get back, that we would take care of each other when we get back. And one of the biggest regrets in my life is that I wasn't able to keep that promise.
This is WJCT's What It's Like, where people share just that. I'm Lindsay Kilbride, and like all the episodes this season, this one starts with a conversation recorded in Jacksonville, Florida by the nonprofit StoryCorps. I followed up with the two people afterward, 36-year-old Army veteran Adam Bagby and his platoon sergeant, 58-year-old David Gilchrist. They both deployed to Iraq in 2003. And their story is about war, and what happened might be upsetting to some listeners.
What do you think is one of the most lasting impacts that you have from Iraq?
I guess one of the lasting impacts that I have is that I took a bunch of really, I'm sorry, I hate to say it, but I took a bunch of kids into a war zone. And I and everybody else was asked to do something that actually should never be asked of anybody. And you and I, well, all of us were asked to do that. And we saw things that people really shouldn't see. We did things that people shouldn't be asked to do. We did our mission. We took care of each other.
I'd have to say my lasting impact is how the war really actually has affected me on a personal level and from a physical perspective. Because as you remember, you know, we got blown up in our Humvee in Iraq,
yeah.
And I got shrapnel in my hand and my arm and my knee. I have to say, some of the psychological problems that I've been having is nightmares. You know, stuff like that. Sounds kind of trigger certain emotional responses.
Even Adam's memory of crossing into Iraq for the first time sticks with him.
And I saw a car that was on fire. It was on the side of the road. It looks like a old taxi or something. And so there was this arm hanging out of the front driver's side window, and attached to the arm, a guy was holding on to an AK-47, but the car was on fire, and you could see that it was like a kind of skeletal remains of the arm. But still, it's when I saw that, that's when I was like, this is real. This is real life. And
was that the first time you'd ever seen anybody dead, other than like a funeral family member?
Yeah.
David said there's really no way to prepare someone for seeing a dead body for the first time or being the person who caused it. Even he, who had the most training in the platoon, was embarking on something totally new. The closest had been a peacekeeping mission in Bosnia. But in Iraq, he said, you didn't know who you were fighting or what the conditions would be. And Adam had never been deployed anywhere. He'd been 19 when he joined the Army, just 2 months before 9/11. So on September 11th, 2001, he was in basic training, his first day learning his actual job.
I was in this big classroom, and we were learning about paperwork, and the lights came on, the drill sergeant's cell phone started going off, and everybody, the drill sergeant said, everybody, massive formation, outside, now, go. We didn't have any access to any media at all. Mm-hmm. And so we were there, and I was like, okay, guys, so what they're probably going to do is they're just going to see how we react. So this is a psychological exercise. They're going to have us go in formation, and they're going to walk down the line. They're going to ask us, are you ready to go to war for this country? Do you love your country? And I'm like, so whatever you do, just say yes. You're ready to go. This is what we do. This is what we signed up for. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, we found out that it was real.
And that job he was learning, he'd now be using in war. He was trained as a gunner, meaning he'd be standing up in the Humvee, ready to shoot if necessary. He, his Sergeant David, and the rest of their team formed Platoon 2, the Vikings. They'd spend about a year in Iraq. Their mission involved establishing a police force, transporting supplies across the desert, and securing them. Did you want to be deployed?
Oh, that's a good question. When I signed up in peacetime. So I wasn't looking to go to war. But if America went to war, that's what I signed up for. So I mean, my family has got a history with the military, a very honorable history with the military. And by God, I'm not going to be the one to ruin that. So no, I was ready to do my part.
Doing his part meant nearly dying several times.
There were times when I was incapacitated. I had a heat stroke. I was poisoned, blown up. Yeah, we were constantly shot at, like all the time.
And it didn't take them long to learn. Any road they traveled on put them at risk of possibly hitting an improvised explosive device, an IED. And there was a lot of driving between IP stations, that's Iraqi police stations. But Adam always stuck with his driver, Rachel Bosveld.
We took care of each other. We took care of the truck. Just getting to know her, she was incredibly creative, artistic. She played a violin. She painted. I mean, this girl was pretty amazing. And she would talk to me and she's like, buck up, little soldier. She knew how to talk to me in a way to get me to respond. And it was always awesome to have her around. She had a certain singers that she liked. She liked to sing. She liked Alanis Morissette.
Which is actually who they were listening to the day their luck ran out. Adam talked to a sergeant about that night in the StoryCorps booth.
She played Isn't It Ironic by Alanis Morissette. And that was right after that song ended. We got in the truck and we were headed to Abu Ghraib.
Yeah.
And it was probably about 11:30 at night, almost close to 12. Went to go use the bathroom. And when I came back is when I put my hand on the door and I opened the door a little bit. And there was this explosion out in the IP station. It was so loud that I was deaf. I couldn't hear anything.
Yeah.
Thorne comes running up to me. And he, like, asks for the first aid kit, only I didn't know that's what he was asking for. But then he drew a cross on my chest, and that's when I knew, oh, he's looking for the first aid kit. It's out in the truck. So I go out there, and I see a headlight from one of the Humvees. Busby was actually hanging out of the Humvee.
Yeah.
And I got him, and I put him on my back, and the fireman carried him into the IP station. And then right behind him is when they brought in Monroe.
Yeah.
And is when they brought in Rachel. Monroe, who I actually took off my body top, my armor, and I took off my ACU top, and I took my T-shirt, and I ripped it in half. Mm-hmm. And you remember the squeegee we used to clean the floor in the bathroom? Because that's where we brought everybody. We brought everybody into the bathroom. I took that squeegee, and I snapped it in half, and I used the wood, and I put it through the sleeve, and I took the T-shirt, and I wrapped it around. See, Monroe's legs looked like hamburger.
Tourniquet, I know. Mean,
yeah, so that's what we did. And then there was Rachel. She had labored breathing, and her pupils were dilated, and her breaths keep getting shallower and shallower. So I took off her armor, I took off her ACU top, and everything looked normal. Like there was no entry or exit wounds, no blood or anything. So I rolled her ever so gently over, and I felt around her back, and I looked, and I didn't see any blood or anything. So I couldn't figure it out, and I thought maybe it was just shock and dirt, maybe.
Yeah.
But we found out later on it wasn't.
Rachel didn't make it. She was radioed in a KIA, killed in action. It was a mortar attack.
I knew it was one of mine. I knew that I had one big fear. And I guess that throughout the whole thing, I promised myself and I promised that you guys, I promised to you all that we would all get back, that we would take care of each other when we get back. And one of the biggest regrets in my life is that I wasn't able to keep that promise. And for a long time, I blamed myself that I didn't keep the promise, and that that somehow I could have prevented it. That was the worst thing, is somehow I could have told you all something, or somehow I could have done something that could have prevented it. And it's taken me a long time to deal with it. We went over to the hospital that they had in the green zone. And I remember walking into the room where Monroe was. And I remember seeing Monroe in there. And there was also an Iraqi that was in there. He was on life support. And the Iraqi had been planning an IED. And so it put a, you know, like it's a kind of duality where you have one of your soldiers laying there. And you have the person that is trying to kill your soldiers on the opposite side. And it's a hard thing to deal with.
David isn't the only one who holds on to that attack. Adam does too. He said it's the main source of his post-traumatic stress disorder, which shows up in dreams and is triggered by noise. Most recently, New Year's fireworks. He was with friends in downtown Raleigh, North Carolina, walking back to his hotel.
You know, I tried looking around me. I tried looking up. I looked around, and I couldn't identify where they were coming from. And the intensity of the fireworks just grew and grew and grew and grew. And then eventually they got to the finale, and I'm like, I felt unprotected. I felt completely exposed out in the open, and I couldn't, I started shaking. I had to get over to a wall, and I just leaned against the wall. I was just in this like phase of like just non-functionality, just completely. And in my mind, it took me back to the battle when we where we lost Boz. And I don't know why, like when you have PTSD, I don't know why certain battles come up and certain battles don't. Mm-hmm. I guess it's maybe the battles that really impacted you.
Is that the main one?
That's the one that's the source. That's mm-hmm. the one that's at the very core of me.
Adam's wife called David.
I didn't really know how to talk him out of it. And I wasn't sure how to do that. And I just kept reassuring him that he was safe. And Adam was using vernacular that, you know, he was on the radio talking to me. And so finally it was just, I had to talk to him. Like I had to switch back. Like I was the platoon sergeant again and not just a friend, and try and get him talked in and trying to tell him that his mission was complete and that he was safe. There's a lot of us. I read something the other day, and it said that something to the effect that everybody that goes through war is changed, and that not all the scars are visible. And it's very true. It's not the first time that I've had to talk somebody down, a war vet.
Do you ever worry that you carry this with you, that it's going to impact, you know, your relationships?
I already know that night I was saying things and I was doing things that night that I already know our friends, they won't ever see me the same way ever again. Now, my wife, she's seen me have attacks before, mm-hmm. but that one scared her. I'm afraid that my daughters, one of the biggest things that I'm afraid of is to have something like that happen. And they're actually around me. After that happened, I could tell you the next morning, somebody mentioned to them that, you know, be careful around Daddy. You know, Daddy wasn't himself last night. And so, like, when they came into my room, they were saying, make sure when you tap him, make sure you say, I'm Tessa or I'm Cecily. And I heard them saying that. And it hurt me. It hurt my heart. To answer your question more directly, yes, I am afraid.
Honestly, we had suffered enough. We had suffered enough, and we took our hits, but we did our mission. But I want to tell you, and I'll tell any of the guys, any of the young ladies that listen to this that belong to us, that I am so damn proud of each and every one of you, because we put you through hell. You lived through hell. Each one of you all has lived your life and made your life full, maybe not complete, but full and a hell of a lot better. And I can't thank you enough.
Mm-hmm. This is What It's Like, a production made possible by the supporters of WJCT. This episode was based on a conversation recorded by StoryCorps in Jacksonville, Florida. It was produced by me, Lindsay Kilbride, with editing by Jessica Palumbo. And some of the music in this episode is by our intern, Al Pete. Subscribe to hear more stories like this one.
The people were harder to deal with than the actual loss of the baby.
Can we say one last thing? I guess if we're going to dedicate this to anybody,
yeah,
that the first person that we have to dedicate this to is PFC Rachel Boswell.